dear listeners, before we get to the episode, we want to take a moment to address the June 24th, 2022 Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. This decision stripped away the right to have a safe and legal abortion.
Everyone should have the freedom to decide what's best for themselves and their families, including when it comes to ending a pregnancy. This decision has dire consequences for individual health and safety, and could have harsh repercussions for other landmark decisions.
Restricting access to comprehensive reproductive care, including abortion, threatens the health and independence of all of us.
Learn more by visiting podvoices.help. If you're able to support others, please consider donating to abortion funds, as Planned Parenthood and Democrats generally have enough money. You can help by donating to local abortion funds, and to find out where to donate for each state, you can visit donationsforabortion.com. That's the number four, donationsforabortion.com.
We encourage you to speak up, take care, and spread the word. Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast about nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Emily, and I use pronouns like they, them, theirs.
And I'm Pastor Kay, and my pronouns are she, her. In this episode, we'll discuss the fifth Sunday after Pentecost, also known as Proper 10 or Lectionary 15, which this year falls on the 10th of July.
Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode.
We do have some content notes for you today. In the deep dive, we mentioned the rape of Dinah in the Bible. We discussed the Supreme Court and the military and other types of coups and rising fascism in the gospel reading. So our deep dive for today is on the topic of the Samaritans. And I know that many of us may have grown up learning different things in our Christian churches about the Samaritans. Who are they to the Jews? It may be a question that you find yourself asking. Are they the cousins on the family tree that have a contentious relationship with the Jewish people? Or are they truly contemptible enemies? As we look back at history, it seems like the relationship varies somewhat over time, I suppose, like you'd expect. After northern Israel and Judah split in two, and the kingdom of Israel was no longer unified, Assyria conquered the northern Israel kingdoms and took many of the people there into exile. And those who remained behind became the Samaritans over the course of several generations, which is why, for the most part, we see references to the Samaritans in the New Testament, but not so much in the Hebrew Scriptures, because they came along later.
So, as Kay mentioned, Samaritans were from the Northern Kingdom, which is sometimes called Israel and sometimes called Ephraim, in contrast to Judah, which is the Southern Kingdom, and get their name from the capital, Samaria. In the split-off, the Southern Kingdom continued with David's descendants, and the Northern Kingdom had a series of charismatic leaders. And so that includes, like, if you're going biblically, that includes in 1 Kings 16, Ahab, who is the husband of Jezebel, who constructed an altar to Baal in Samaria, which then King Jehu turned it into a latrine in 2 Kings 10. So, you know, we're full of profaning the sacred in scripture.
Yeah.
Well, what some people consider sacred.
Yeah.
And then, as Kay mentioned, in 722 BC, the Northern Kingdom was conquered by Assyrians, and the Assyrians sent lots of people into exile. The actual numbers are a little bit unsure, but it was in the, like, over 20,000 is what they report.
Yeah.
Again, who knows what accurate numbers are, because those oftentimes can be inflated or deflated.
Myriads is probably a good
myriads.
Term for it.
Myriads! I love that term. Yes. So they sent myriads into exile, and then while those people were gone, they imported people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim. And I might be probably mispronouncing those. So that they could populate the area and care for the land and all of that stuff. And that's where the identity of Samaritans from Samaria really took hold. And then after a bit, Babylon, not to be confused with Babylon 5.
That's a space station.
right?
This is not a space station. I hope.
I mean, technically, everything is in space. Like, this idea that Earth is, like, not space is problematic. That's fair. But not, like, a space station, really. Right. Not that kind of technology.
I figure we would have figured that out by now, if that were the case.
Yeah. So, Babylon conquered Assyria and then the Southern Kingdom. And then Cyrus of Persia conquered Babylon. And he repatriated the Judahites, so the people of the Southern Kingdom. And they had plans to rebuild the nation and the temple, and that is the point at which kind of this enmity between Samaritans and Jews really developed.
Yeah, when they got back from the Babylonian exile. Repatriated means sent home, essentially.
Yes. So the Jews in the Southern Kingdom wanted to rebuild the temple and were rebuilding and resecuring walls, and Samaritans were not happy with that. But then in about 388 BCE, the Samaritans constructed their own temple on Mount Gerizim. That stayed for 260 years. But after about 55 years, Alexander the Great made Samaria into a Greek city. And the Samaritans, it seems like, kind of just went along with that. The Jewish people were upset with the Samaritans because they rebelled in their rebellion against assimilationist policies in 165 BCE. They wanted the Samaritans to come help them, and the Samaritans did not come to their aid. And so that was a further dividing, where there's some accusations around, like, identifying with Judaism and the Abrahamic tradition when it's convenient and not when it's not. So that's part of the enmity between them.
Sure.
And then the Jewish king, John Hyrcanus, attacked and burned down the temple at Mount Gerizim in 128 BCE. And it wasn't until Herod the Great that both temples were actually rebuilt. I think I learned about Herod rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem, but not the temple in Mount Gerizim.
Sure.
So in that context, both Samaritans and Jews understand themselves as descendants of Abraham, with true understanding of Torah, correct priesthood, and the right form of worship in the proper location. And the Samaritans think that the Jews got off track at about the time of Samuel, when Eli set up a heretical sanctuary at Shiloh. And they also were not fans of adding the prophets and the writings to the Pentateuch or the Torah.
Right.
And so this information that I have, I will say, just as a plug, comes from the book Short Stories by Jesus by Amy Jill Levine, who is a Jewish New Testament scholar who Kay and I both love and appreciate.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I got a lot of it from this, which does this great analysis of, among other things, the story of the quote-unquote Good Samaritan. But she also is the editor of the Jewish Annotated New Testament, where we got other information as well.
So, as Dr. Levine says in Short Stories by Jesus, the Samaritan's compassion then becomes, for many of today's interpreters, the hook by which the sermon functions. In a number of settings, the parable serves as a warning against prejudice. For example, the two who walk by are a pastor and a choir director, while the Samaritan is a gay man, an illegal immigrant, a person on parole, or any other victim of bigotry. The point in this reading is that they are really nice, that we sometimes fail in our obligations to help, and that we too should have compassion on those who are mistreated. End quote. And I was interested to find that, of all people, Isaac Asimov actually had a take on this interpretation of this parable. He wrote an essay called Lost in Non-Translation, and he suggested that since to the Jews of the time there were no good Samaritans, in his view, that was basically half of the point of this parable. And as he put it, his suggestion was that we think of this as the story itself occurring in Alabama in 1950, with a mayor and a preacher ignoring the man who's been beaten and robbed, and the role of the Samaritan played by a poor black sharecropper. Thank you to Wikipedia for that snatch of info. Dr. Amy Jill Levine would suggest a slightly different take on this parable instead, going back to Short Stories by Jesus. But to understand the parable as did its original audience, we need to think of Samaritans less as oppressed but benevolent figures, and more as the enemy, as those who do the oppressing. From the perspective of the man in the ditch, Jewish listeners might balk at the idea of receiving Samaritan aid. They might have thought, I'd rather die than acknowledge that one from that group saved me. I do not want to acknowledge that a rapist has a human face, or I do not want to recognize that a murderer will be the one to rescue me.
And this, I thought, was really interesting, because it is, like, the ways that we have in contemporary society, like, the number of times I have heard of the Good Samaritan being a queer person is a lot.
Yes.
It's a lot.
Yep.
And I do think that this, like, this idea, the other thing that Amy Jill Levine mentions that I didn't include in this, but is that when we associate the Good Samaritan as oppressed but kind, it pits, it's actually anti-Semitic, right? It makes the Jewish audience and the Jewish participants the bad ones, right?
Right. The priests. And that's not the goal.
Right. And that's not the goal, and that's not reality.
Right.
So I was thinking about, like, who would be in this category, and it's almost like Wicked and those, like, the flipping the script kind of shows and plays and movies where the one who we've, right, like, I grew up and the Wicked Witch of the West
was your classic evil, not mustache twirling villain because she didn't have one, but, you know,
but she was evil. And then Wicked says, actually, she's trying to do this good thing. And it's kind of like that. It doesn't quite completely get to it, but kind of hints at it.
Yeah, thinking about various pop culture options, I was considering Deadpool as an example. Deadpool from the Marvel universe is a mercenary rather than a superhero or a villain, and he does sometimes do evil things, and he also does sometimes do good things, and he has some extraordinarily serious mental health issues that kind of exacerbate all of that and his bounce back and forth. But in general, especially in the comics, I have not actually seen the movies myself. He is usually trying to be some version of a good person, but he also does actually need to get a paycheck. And then as time goes on, he will get steadily more and more frustrated by the trials and frustrations of being a good person, which do not seem to, like, net him any good results whatsoever, and in fact often get him in more trouble and more injured. And eventually he snaps and gives up on it again, and there's this ongoing cycle.
Yeah. And I was thinking that maybe then, like, Dexter or The Sopranos might be more of an accurate one. It's complicated because particularly right now where we are politically as a country, there's so much harm being caused and dehumanization being perpetrated against Jewish people, people with uteruses, queer people, Black, Indigenous people of color.
Immigrants.
Right, we mentioned in our pre-roll about Roe v. Wade, that was not the only Supreme Court decision to come out in June, and they were, almost all of the decisions were awful, rolling back sovereignty, tribal sovereignty, all sorts of things. And so the idea of then taking a story and a perspective and saying, like, Steve Bannon is the Samaritan is problematic because we have a faith that picks those who are not perpetrating abuse.
Right. Yeah. See, I was going the exact opposite with this direction myself and wondering, is this the year when the Samaritan becomes an abortion doctor? Probably again, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, people who provide abortions save lives.
Yep.
But also.
Yeah. And I think it depends on the perspective that we're coming from, right? If we are coming from...
Your setting will determine whether or not that's an appropriate choice.
And so, like, you and I, as people with uteruses, and, like, as a non-binary person for me, I'm not necessarily coming from a place of power or privilege, but as white people, we are. And so, like, as white people, I think it's more helpful and more important for us to think of this as Amy Jill Levine kind of tries to get us into of... recognizing the humanity of those who are incarcerated, for example.
Sure.
That so frequently it's, they don't deserve rights, they don't deserve anything, and the reality is, yeah, they are still human.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was thinking, what about The Mandalorian? The Mandalorian, I think, is actually, like, the perfect example, because he He's a mercenary. He's a bounty hunter. He goes to, like, kill and capture. And that's what he's supposed to do to Grogu. And then Grogu captures his heart and he ends up, like, helping Grogu a lot and going way out of his way to help Grogu instead.
Because he's adorable.
It's but, true. Yes. Yeah. So, as Amy Jill Levine and particularly the Jewish Annotated New Testament continues to kind of tease out this parable, like, Jewish people understand themselves to be the descendants of the priests, descendants of the Levites, or descendants of the rest of the Israelites. So when Jesus is telling the parable, it is the priest passes by, the Levite passes by, and the expected third person is the Israelite.
Right.
But the parable, as they say in the Jewish Annotated New Testament, the parable shocks by making the third person not the expected Israelite, but the unexpected Samaritan, the enemy of the Jews. It thus evokes 2 Chronicles 28:8-15, wherein enemy Samaritans care for Jewish victims, even as it reframes the lawyer's question. The issue is not, who is my neighbor, but can we recognize that the enemy might be our neighbor, and can we accept this disruption of our stereotypes?
And when you think about it, there already is an Israelite in this story, the man who was beaten and robbed.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he and the Samaritan switched places, because in the expected version of this story, it would be the Israelite helping the Samaritan, right? Being the bigger person.
Yeah. When we think about the Samaritans, there's not just the history that we've already talked about. In the biblical narratives, Samaria in the Hebrew scriptures is called Shechem. Shechem.
Right.
So we'll link to a kind of a word search of scripture with Samaritan and with Shechem, so that you can kind of get a sense of where it is. But Shechem in the Hebrew Bible particularly, and therefore Samaritans particularly, evoke the place where Dinah, Jacob's daughter, was raped in Genesis 34, and the place where the false judge Abimelech murders his rivals in Judges 8 and 9. And so it really is, like, in scripture, when Samaritan comes up, that's the image that would come up for those initial hearers of the parable in this case. So then, right, it is the good murderer, the good rapist.
Right.
Like, I think it's important to recognize that humanity, and it's hard.
Yeah.
And to be clear, like, that doesn't mean making what they do okay, right? When we're trying to, like, understand it in today's terms, it doesn't mean that having committed murder is okay. But it does mean that maybe the stereotypes we make about big groups of people around rape and murder in particular are
probably
not
helpful.
Accurate or helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I think we can take a moment to acknowledge that while you and I have studied these kinds of things on a fairly regular basis for several years, we are both still, you know, white American people, and probably there's a lot of nuance that we're missing here. We're trying, but if you are listening to this and you are an expert on Israelite-Samaritan relations and the history thereof, hey, we'd love to hear from you. That would be awesome.
Yes.
So.
Yes, we have done research. This is not just, like, us making stuff up.
Yeah.
But there is, as there always is in anything scripture-related or Middle East-related, a lot more nuance than can be summarized in a deep dive.
I took an entire college-level course on the history of the modern Middle East, and, like, a third of that course was the professor saying, and there's a lot more to this, but we don't really have time to get into it.
Yep.
So,
yeah. And so then the parable that's today's gospel, the person in the ditch is who the listener is most likely to identify with, as Kay mentioned. And that calls into mind 2 Chronicles 28, which is this time when God was upset with the Israelites, with the folks in the southern kingdom, and so handed them over to the people of the northern kingdom, who just desecrated, demolished, wiped them out. And then the king was like, so God was mad at them and, like, did this, but then you did all of this harm, and that's not okay, and calls them out on it. And so then they take, like, all that they had looted, and they give it back to the people and help the people get back home, and even use some of the same language that Jesus uses to talk about what the Samaritan does to the person who was robbed.
Sure.
So that's I think, a connection that I didn't know until we were preparing for this episode.
Right.
But I think it's a helpful holding those two side by side.
Yeah. And as you may be wondering, yes, Samaritan people do still exist. There are somewhere between 800 to 1,000 Samaritans in the modern world, depending on how and exactly where you count. Mm-hmm. There are two larger modern communities in the Israel area. One of them is in the city of Holon, and the other one is in the West Bank. And they occasionally intermarry with Jewish people. Jewish people will convert to being Samaritans. Samaritans will convert to being Jewish. And there's also an additional handful of Samaritans in Brazil and in Sicily. These days, they would explain their religious standing by, again, saying that they considered modern Judaism to have been changed by Judah's exile in Babylon, and so they consider themselves the original Israelite faith, the best representation of it in the modern world. And they have their own scripts or alphabet, which is mostly used in a religious context, and in looks, at least, it looks somewhat similar in appearance to both Hebrew and Arabic. And you can see an example of that on the Wikipedia page for Samaritan.
And we'll link to the website that we have for them.
Yes, so they do have a website in which they explain a whole bunch of different things about themselves and their culture, including the four principles of faith that they uphold. One Almighty God, one prophet, which is to say Moses, one holy book, which is the Torah, and one chosen holy place, which is Mount Gerizim. And in explaining why Mount Gerizim instead of Jerusalem, they point towards Deuteronomy chapters 11 and 12. And they do also have a English language cookbook, which is available for sale on their website. I have not actually had a chance to look at it, but that intrigued me. So.
Gotcha. So specifically, Mount Gerizim comes up on Deuteronomy 11:29, where it said, "When the Becoming One, your God, has brought you into the land that you are entering to occupy, you shall set the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal." And so I think that's just like, that was in the context of, like, you are entering this land that God has promised to you to be a good place.
Yeah.
And that's the place of it. I do think it's fascinating, the, like, discrepancy between the northern and southern kingdoms, because I always was like, well, the northern kingdom is actually where God was like, yeah, go here. And then the people in the southern right. kingdom were like, meh, we're okay here. And I was always like, and then the southern kingdom is one that, like, carries the Davidic line.
Lasts longer, and yeah.
So I was like, this is weird, but okay. Also, I'm excited about the Samaritan cookbook. I imagine it is at least as good as a church cookbook, possibly as good as, like, one of the Great British Baking Show cookbooks, and certainly better than some.
Yeah, church cookbooks vary widely.
They're hit or miss a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's some about the Samaritans. I think it's helpful for us to know more of the context and the history of it, especially as we're now entering the month of wrath. Last month was the month of pride, and we are recording on day one of the month of wrath. I do think it's interesting, and I think each of us probably have to ask ourselves individually, like, who would the Samaritan be? If I were in a ditch.
Yeah.
Right? But who would I
not want to receive help from?
Yeah. And I think, and that's the scary part, is there are people I would not feel safe receiving sure. help from.
But that's the other part, in that we don't know that the guy who was going to Jericho didn't feel safe with the Samaritan. Like, he is apparently unconscious.
Right, he's half dead.
Yeah, so he doesn't have the oh crap moment himself mm-hmm. until after he's already recovering and the Samaritan is no longer there.
Yeah. And I'm reminded also of some of the conversation that we had with Ale last week, and that space of, like, when I learned about community organizing, there are different ways to do community organizing. And one of the things in faith-based organizing in particular, which Alexia Salvatierra has a wonderful book called Faith-Based Organizing.
Yes.
Part of that is the recognition that, like, it's not that you have targets or enemies, it's figuring out and keeping in mind that those who are oppressing, those who are committing injustice,
yeah.
are human. And so how do you appeal to their humanity? And how do you do organizing yeah. in such a way that draws them to be their to their fullest humanity. And right now we're in a place where it's hard to imagine that. It is hard to imagine a way to convince Supreme Court justices that have again and again and again taken away rights and enforced and allowed for the enforcement of conservative Christian beliefs and practices in public space, in like public spaces where kids are vulnerable. Like, it is hard to imagine any way to appeal to their humanity. Like, I don't know how to do it. And so that's why I think I'm struggling with a contemporary comparison to the Samaritans.
That feels faithful, but also feels possible. Yeah. The conversation that I've had before that I am now reminded of is the conversation of the intersection of the pastoral and the prophetic, in that clergy have both a pastoral and a prophetic role. And my understanding of the combination of the two is that being prophetic is helpful, but the goal ultimately is to bring as many people with us as we can. And that's where the pastoral comes in. You are pastoral in order to draw folks toward the prophetic.
That's interesting. I have heard the prophetic is pastoral to certain people, right?
Like, yes, it very much can
be. And so it, yeah.
But often when people are trying to say that they are two separate things, that is how I explain binary. That they are. Well, yes, obviously. But that is how I started thinking about it at the beginning and have stuck with, because, you know, I am prophetic toward the hardliners who I know perfectly well will never come around to my side or the gospel side of things, because their cousins and friends and so forth are also listening to me, and these people will go and complain about me to those other people, and those people might come around.
Well, and those people might find it pastoral, right? Like, I am going to counteract when somebody is being queerphobic or when somebody is being racist. I'm going to counteract that because other people might see, both from a, maybe their hearts will be changed, but also maybe they need to hear that that is not the only way.
Right.
And that their identity is valuable. Yeah.
So, yes. I hope that our deep dive was helpful. I hope we didn't misrepresent anyone. And again, if there are any experts out there who would like to talk to us about this, please, by all means, get in touch.
Yes.
We'd be delighted.
Angry emails, always welcome.
Non-angry emails, also always welcome.
Also non-angry emails. I hope that we didn't completely screw up what you're going to preach on, but I think we might have, because I think we did to me, so...
And if you're not going to preach, I hope that we, you know, gave you a different perspective to hear whatever sermon you're going to hear.
Yes.
On this Sunday. Yeah.
Yes. We have a wide variety of listeners who we appreciate.
Absolutely. Speaking of readings.
Indeed. Our first reading is Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 9 through 14. Moses tells the people of Israel that God will reward their obeying the commandments with prosperity, and that it will be possible and reasonable for them to do so, because God's word is in their mouths and hearts. So one of the themes in this passage is the idea of prosperity. God promises prosperity to the people of Israel, and this is not prosperity from war, though war is one of the most common national ways to stimulate the economy after a recession or depression. Think about, like, the Great Depression in the 30s and what came next. And
if you read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, that will explain a lot.
Yep. So also think about that in our contemporary context. But this is not that. This is more like in Leverage Redemption, when Noah Wiley's character, before he joins up, right? Like, this is, nope, come on. We're going to do prosperity the right way, not just this way where you're taking advantage of everybody. And then in verse 9 we read, "And the Becoming One, your God, will make you abundantly prosperous in all your undertakings, in the fruit of your body, in the fruit of your livestock, and in the fruit of your soil. For the Becoming One will again take delight in prospering you, just as she delighted in prospering your ancestors." And this made me think of the Great British Baking Show, which is apparently a theme for this episode.
Were you hungry when you were putting together your notes for this episode?
Yes, it was last night. it was last night. Indeed, I was hungry. But, like, on the Great British Baking Show, occasionally, like, there will be certain bakers who have, like, some special ingredient that they bring from their garden, from, like, bees, from family. And sometimes it's, like, a cultural thing, but sometimes it's, like, I grew this rhubarb from my home or whatever. And so thinking about the different, the fruit of your body, probably there, I mean, I guess baking is the fruit of your body, but the fruit of your livestock, right? If you had, like, a particular type of cheese or a particular meat and the fruit of your soil, the veggies and the fruits and the herbs. And
sure, absolutely.
Now I'm hungry again and I want to bake.
Well, we'll just have to keep moving through these verses. In verse 10, we read, "When you obey the Lord your God by observing his commandments and decrees that are written in this book of the law, because you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." And I've heard people object to the idea that turning to God would automatically mean following a set of commandments. And I can kind of see where, like, depending on your background, that could be a pretty, like, twisted and hurtful concept, depending on how rules and commandments have worked in your life. That makes sense. But also, like, when you turn to some people in your life, that's going to change what you do. When you go over to some people's homes, you take your shoes off. When you go over to other people's places, you don't drink alcohol while you're there. When you go over to visit other people, you do not, under any circumstances, bring up the Star Wars versus Star Trek debate for the 50th time for crying out loud. Like, there are rules that you follow around some people, and that's okay. And that is a sign that you are turning toward them, that they matter to you.
I love that example. That's fantastic.
The Star Wars versus Star Trek debate is usually not so much a spoken but a unspoken one, and usually not so much about doing what they want you to do, but doing what you've realized is probably the best for everyone involved.
Yes, that's what I was guessing.
Yeah.
Well, and in verse 11, the next verse, we read, "Surely this commandment that I am commanding you today is not too hard for you, nor is it too far away," right? This is not supposed to be some impossible task. It's more like the Lord of the Rings when they're stuck in the Mines of Moria and they're trying to get in, and Gandalf is, like, trying to decipher what the password is because he reads in Elvish and it says, "Speak, friend, and enter." And he's trying to do this, like, very complicated analysis and figure things out. And then I forget which hobbit it is, but one of the hobbits is like,
In the movie, I think it's Frodo, actually. But
I thought it was somebody else, but
In the movie, but in the book it might be someone else.
Okay, I thought it was Merry or Pippin, but I don't know.
Very possibly.
And they're like, Gandalf, what's the word for friend in Elvish? And he's like, Maloch. I don't remember what he says, but he says the word for friend in Elvish, and then it opens. It's a lot
simpler. A wizard overthinking things? Right? I'm shocked.
Wow. So it's a lot simpler than he gives it credit for, and I think we do that too.
Yeah.
There is a simplicity in God's commands, and that doesn't make it easy. That doesn't make it that we're not going to mess up, but it's not always as complicated as we make it out to be.
And then in verse 13, we read, "Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will cross to the other side of the sea for us and get it for us so that we may hear it and observe it." That is God's law. And, you know, occasionally, sometimes I wonder if we would pay more attention to following God's commandments and living as God calls us to if it was harder. Like, if it was something that you could brag about, like a triathlon score or doing the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs.
Which is always what the Kessel Run is going to be.
Well, no, actually, interestingly enough, when Han Solo brags about having done the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs, that line does make sense. You just have to think about it like a pilot and not like a race car driver. Because a parsec is a unit of distance.
Yeah.
And what Han Solo is bragging about is his really excellent job of having set a course that involved having to cover less distance than it would usually, because the Kessel Run involves getting past a blockade, and he did it without having to make a gigantic, really long loop that would have taken a long time to get around.
Okay.
He managed to bypass the blockade by traveling a fairly short path. And that's what he's bragging about. It's not about how fast his ship was. So actually, he's saying he's a really good navigator, which, you know, in his situation, it makes sense and is something to brag about when you're a smuggler. So.
Yeah. Okay, that makes more sense. I like that.
Yeah.
Also, it reminds me of Naaman, the story of Naaman in the Bible, where he's he has leprosy.
It doesn't have to be super complicated.
Right? And he's like,
just go wash in the river already.
And Babbitt's like, I can't be bothered to actually come see you. Go wash in the river and you'll be fine. And he's like, ma, 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 ma. And then he does it and he's fine.
How dare you not give me special things to do.
Yeah, so apparently this is a long tradition of wanting to do harder things because they're harder.
Yeah, no, it's not that complicated. Just, again, sometimes it just boils down to don't be a jerk.
Yep.
And then our next reading is from Colossians chapter 1, verses 1 through 14. The author greets the Colossians with thankfulness and prayers, praising God for the many gifts they have been given.
So, as we begin our dive into Colossians, it begins with encouragement. The author is encouraging the people, Colossae. And so then I was thinking about, like, where there's encouragement. And, like, Lia in An Ember in the Ashes, her armband, her silver armband, is a source of encouragement for her. And, like, Katniss receives encouragement when people do the, like, three-finger salute thing to her in the districts. And there's not always a lot of... I had a little bit of trouble coming up with, like, encouragement. There's so much individualism in a lot of...
That salute always made me think of Katniss as being a Girl Scout, because that's also the Girl Scout salute.
Right? Yeah.
But, yeah. And also, it's a symbol of a benediction in the Christian church. That's how saints were often depicted as blessing people.
Or they do it in the, like, ASL version of three.
Yeah.
That includes the thumb, pointer, and middle fingers.
Sure.
Jewish people do Spock style. That's actually where it comes from.
Oh, yes, that's right, because, of course, Leonard Nimoy was Jewish, and so he, I think he borrowed it, or someone suggested that he borrow it, but it's become the symbol for live long and prosper, but actually it's a Jewish symbol that means much the same thing, I think.
Yeah, and then as we dive into the verses, in the second verse we read, to the saints and faithful siblings in Christ in Colossae, grace to you and peace from God our caregiver. I mean, this is frequently how the epistles, the letters in the Bible are written, but I love this idea of, like, queer chosen family, right? Like, we are all siblings, we've got a parent, a caregiver, we're all connected. And it reminded me of Sense8, where, like, they're just they're a pretty random group that gets connected, like a random group of 8 people scattered throughout the world who get connected telepathically. But
awkward.
You know, a little awkward, but also that's, like, that's what queer chosen family is. There's a little bit of awkwardness and a little bit of, like, ooh, how'd this person wind up here? And yet, they do, and there's some beauty to it.
Yeah.
And then in verse 3, we read, in our prayers for you, we always thank God, the caregiver of our Lord Jesus Christ. And you know that Harry and Ron did not give nearly enough thanks for Hermione.
No, that would take another book.
Yeah. Also... in Encanto, I feel like Mirabelle also could have done with a letter to Colossians, because there's so much that she does for the family in so many ways that she holds the family together and does not receive the gratitude of the family until the very end of the movie when they're like, oh, you're wonderful, not this, like, scary thing that we have to avoid because you didn't get a gift, but actually your gift is bigger than that.
Or I kind of think that in both of the first two Frozen movies, Elsa does say thank you to Anna, but, like, it really, given everything that Anna's done.
Right. Yeah.
More thank you would not be out of place. Yeah.
And, like, a thank you that doesn't then immediately discount all of that.
Yeah, that would help as well. And, you know, then not maybe immediately distracting with her magical gifts would be, yeah. And then in verse 6b, just because verse 6 starts in the middle of a sentence, going to the rest of the verse, just as it is bearing fruit and growing in the whole world, so it has been bearing fruit among yourselves from the day you heard it, and it truly comprehended the grace of God. And this image of bearing fruit occurs again and again and again in the Bible, particularly in the New Testament, but we also run into it in the Hebrew Scriptures as well. And I have to wonder, why is it always bearing fruit and never, like, bearing vegetables? vegetables are bearing fungi. Like, I know Emily doesn't like mushrooms, but some of the rest of us do. And variety is good. And admittedly, the town summer festival where I went to high school was literally called Cornfest, so maybe I'm biased. But if it's supposed to be about bearing fruit, then why aren't they called Fruity Tales instead of Veggie Tales? Like, shouldn't Larry and what's-his-face be...
Bob.
You know, Larry and Bob be like an apple and I
no,
because
Bob is a tomato. Bob and tomatoes are fruits.
Oh, that is right. Yes, tomatoes are fruits. So Larry should be a banana
or pineapple
instead.
Yeah, banana
maybe
or pineapple.
Yeah, sure.
I want Larry the pineapple.
Absolutely, I could be on board with that. And then in verse 9, we read. For this reason, since the day we heard it, we have not ceased praying for you and asking that you may be filled with the knowledge of God's will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding. And we talk about this occasionally. There's another passage that I think we discussed in our episode about alcoholism from the Epiphany season. I think it was the second Sunday after Epiphany, quite a while ago, where Paul goes into this very specifically. But knowing God's will and actually carrying it out in life are two very separate and different things. Although knowing God's will is the first step. Like, you do have to know that first. That's fair. But, like, for example, Calvin in Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip, and one of my favorite sources for this podcast, he generally does know his parents' will or his teacher's will. Like, he understands what he's supposed to do. That does not mean that that is what he does. And, in fact, that is basically the point of the comic strip for the most part. So he makes his own choices. And so do we.
It's true. It's true. That's fantastic. And our gospel reading is Luke chapter 10, verses 25 through 37. When questioned by a lawyer on earning everlasting life and justification, Jesus tells the parable of a man cared for by a Samaritan, who was part of a marginalized community and not well thought of by the crowd gathered with Jesus. So one of the themes in this passage is this, like, idea that, like, you have to be the right one, you have to, like, justifying yourself, and that's the lawyer, right? The lawyer is, like, questioning Jesus and then, like, justifying the questioning. And as I was reading it this time, I was like, this feels like Admiral Adama in Battlestar Galactica, particularly when he, like, stages a coup and arrests President Roslin in the episode Kobol's Last Gleaming Part 2. And he's, like, so determined to be right that he will, like, arrest the president and enact a military coup. And, like, I'm a 5, so I know that feeling of needing to be right and, like, the life or death sense of it.
But yeah, also it feels like there are some modern day parallels in America's recent history to that concept.
Yeah.
That might be kind of uncomfortable. Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of, like, gotta justify yourself. The Supreme Court's doing it all the time. They're justifying themselves with, like, terrible thoughts, terrible facts, and untrue things, and yeah.
Oh, I was particularly thinking the staging of a coup and trying to arrest someone.
But, that too. Yeah, that also has happened. You know, trying to... That's the background to the Supreme Court decisions, is...
Speaking of, yeah.
January 6th hearings. Yeah. Don't try to violently overthrow a democratic election? It's also a question about, like, whether or not...
Also, like, if America could get out of the habit of doing that in other countries, that would be great. Well,
that would be awesome.
Just saying.
Yeah, and maybe, like, actually make our voting democratic so that everybody gets a vote.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sorry, folks, I don't think either of us were quite intending to go that far, so now we're a little off track.
No, we weren't, but it is real, and it is the reality we are living in, so...
Yeah.
In verses 26 and 27, we read, Jesus said to him, "What is written in the law? What do you read there?" The lawyer answered, "You shall love the becoming one your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself." And this is actually, like, not an unclear response. Like,
yay.
Yeah. Jesus doesn't try to, like, do some wordsmithing and stuff and, like, just responds with a question. But then there's, like, an easy answer to the question. Unlike the prophecies and the things that are written in, like, An Ember in the Ashes. And most fiction where there's a prophecy where you're like, okay, what does this mean? Hola, Luther. Was ist das? What does this mean?
Actually, come to think of it, I didn't make a note of this at the time, but while we were doing some research on the Samaritans for this episode for the deep dive, I ran across a note that explained the last time that we got a clear answer from Jesus, Jesus was saying, no, don't set people on fire. Setting people on fire is bad, which I think was like 2 weeks ago. And I ran across a note explaining that the reason why the Samaritans in that village had not welcomed him was because he was on that pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And of course, being Samaritans, they would say that if you're going to go on a pilgrimage, you should go to Mount Gerizim. And so the reason why they didn't welcome him was because he was going to Jerusalem instead of Gerizim. And so that is what led to the disciples saying, hey, should we set these people on fire? And Jesus said, no, don't do that. So I found that note interesting, and it is related to what you just brought up. Hmm. But I appreciate when Jesus is not unclear. That's helpful. And then in verse 29 we read, but wanting to justify himself, the lawyer asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? And I kind of love this verse, in part because this moment is so relatable to me. The young lawyer wanted to ask the awesome rabbi a question, and so he did, and then he got a very, like, normal, reasonable answer, which is really not what you expect this guy of all people to say. And so then he asks another question because he wants to justify having stood up and asked the guy a question, right? He wants to, like, make it clear that he is a good thinker himself, and he wants his question to matter. And then he actually does get a really interesting answer. And I was thinking about, like, if you guest starred or even just had a guest cameo, a brief appearance on the TV show West Wing, you would want your character, your cameo, to have a good line or a good question to ask somebody, right? Instead of being one of the people who says one of the silly answers or something like that. But also, additionally, justify and justification have a whole additional meaning in the New Testament, which is about making right one's relationship with God. And so when this guy wants to justify himself, he asks a question about making right one's relationship with God. So this is not quite a pun, but it's like an interesting moment of translation where he's trying to justify himself by asking, how do I justify myself with God? And I kind of enjoyed that. It's pretty close. Yeah. So
I love that. Also, so now, if you were a one-time character on West Wing, which one?
I would be a Muppet. Wait, no, that's not how this goes.
Not yet. Oh my gosh, but can you imagine West Wing Muppets edition?
You know, the Sesame Street characters did show up, and CJ got to meet Big Bird, and that was one of my favorite moments of the show.
It's true, that was adorable. So you would be Big Bird?
I have had it suggested to me that if I was going to be on Sesame Street, Big Bird is definitely an option because I'm actually tall enough. But I do like Big Bird. I don't object to the concept. If I was going to guest on West Wing, the character who I always think of as the, like, very briefly appearing in one episode character is the woman who is working in the bullpen with Donna one day as just a temp, and she has the Star Trek badge on. I love that bit. And she has a very nice couple of scenes, and she's just one very briefly appearing character. I don't even think we have actually ever learned her name, but she's one of my favorites.
The one that came to mind immediately for me was when the kids are visiting and they have been trying to get a meeting to talk about lowering the voting age, and then,
oh yes,
and they finally, like, start talking about it, and then when the president is going on for the press conference, I think it's either CJ or Toby tells the president, if you want to have fun, pick on this kid.
Like, ask, I think it's CJ. Yeah.
Pick this kid for the question.
Ask that kid.
Yeah, and he does. And so that kid gets to ask the president a question and a follow-up question. And I love that.
Yes.
I would totally, like, at that age, have, like, yeah. That was like,
yeah. Mm-hmm,
that's me as that age. Uh-huh. Like, yeah.
Absolutely. And then in verse 34, we read, he went to him, that is, the Samaritan went to him, the robbed man, and bandaged his wounds, having poured oil and wine on them, and then he put him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. And I realize that this verse might sound a little weird to us, like, what's with this whole pouring oil and wine on the wound thing. It's certainly not modern medical care, how we would go about things now. But back in the day, it's not a terrible plan. I'm guessing that the oil is probably olive oil, and very, very few people are allergic to olive oil or allergic to olives, which is something that we learn in our job because of the. That's something that is often mixed with the palm ash on Ash Wednesday if you want to use wet ashes. And you always want to look for something that most people won't be allergic to. Don't use water. It'll make lye. Bad plan. And the olive oil would soothe the battered skin and also clean any dirt out of the wound, especially because water in that era, you couldn't necessarily count on it to be sanitary. Mm-hmm. So you might use the oil instead of water to clean it. And then also the alcohol in the wine would be an antiseptic. So he's not like seasoning the guy or anything, but this is probably just what he had on him at the time and would have helped.
Yeah, I actually have used coconut oil to clean my face because we had Pride weekend last weekend and I did some face painting and
I saw pictures. Yes, yes.
The dark like magenta color in particular and some the dark blue and the dark purple is really hard to get off. And as you saw, Kay, in the pictures, I had, like, this giant butterfly on my face, and the middle, the body of the butterfly was the Bi Pride colors with pink at the top with the antennas and the dots. And then Monday night, I had a meeting with churchy people, and, like, that Sunday night when I was, like, washing, I was like, this is not all coming off.
You might be a little bit more prideful than you were expecting.
Yeah, but the coconut oil actually did an amazing job, like rubbing, like melting coconut oil, rubbing it on, and then just like putting a hot washcloth on for a few minutes and then wiping stuff off. It did a surprisingly good job. I still like put on a little bit of concealer just for a couple scare dots so I didn't have like face paint pox, but yeah. So oil, who knew? Yeah. It also doesn't get rid of all of your, like, natural oils, so then your skin doesn't respond by getting extra oily.
And you might smell slightly like you wore sunscreen that day, but that's going to be about it.
Yeah. And then in verse 37, we read the lawyer's response to Jesus' question that the one who is the neighbor is the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus says to him, go and do likewise. And there's this sense that, like, the guy couldn't even name that it was the Samaritan. And that gets at what Kay and I were talking about in the deep dive, right?
Not, of course, that the Samaritan has a name, but that's a whole separate conversation.
Not that the Samaritan has a name, but, like, couldn't even say the Samaritan.
Right.
And that's part of, like, the mutual enmity between Samaritans and Jews in that time. But it also reminded me of the, like, foot washing images that went around during Holy Week and then, like, went around again recently. Somebody posted a couple of them. Of, like, Jesus washing people's feet, and he, like, washes the current and previous president's feet and, like, police officers' feet and, like, all of this really problematic stuff that, like, actually that's not...
I mean, some of them were okay, but some of them were not.
Some of them were okay.
There's a mix,
but because they were all mixed in together overall, there were a whole bunch of different
dynamics, and,
And so that, like, that sense where, like, we're trying to, like, figure out what it looks like to humanize people, but also, like, in the context of dehumanization, but also in the context of oppression and injustice. And I also was thinking about it when, like, people were finding about, in Battlestar Galactica, when people were finding out about the original five Cylons or whatever, who didn't even know that they were Cylons themselves, and, like, what that looks like, and the space of, like, there's so much built in and built up stereotyping and prejudice that it's hard to recognize those truths. Yeah.
And now for our newest segment, let's make up a Muppets musical where we talk about the passages we've read and cast them with Muppets and the occasional token human in our Bible musical. That one day, I'm sure, will get off the ground. Now, previously, in regards to our first reading, we have cast Samuel L. Jackson as Moses. And let me just say for the record, any time that Samuel L. Jackson would like to appear on screen with some Muppets, I am there. Like, I don't even care what they're doing.
It's true.
That's fine. It's true. Absolutely. However, if we do want to talk about casting the story of the Good Samaritan with Muppets, I was thinking about the Samaritan and the Muppets and saying to myself, I could see Fozzie as the Samaritan, although I realize that he's often, like, mentally cast by Jewish people as being a Jewish Muppet, because Fozzie does tend to collect strays, And that seems like what this guy is kind of all about. So that kind of makes sense to me.
I actually wonder about Oscar the Grouch.
Okay, say more.
Like, if we're thinking about someone who is not necessarily appreciated, is not necessarily liked, like, Oscar the Grouch is grumpy and doesn't always get along with people. And so then to have Oscar the Grouch be the one who, like, comes along and finds the person and then, like...
Yeah, I could see that. And he could carry them in his trash can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just pop them in
and the trash can. And how he moves is always, like, kind of, I think, kind of mysterious. It's not really... And so his ability to get to the inn, we wouldn't question because this is Oscar and we don't ask how he gets around.
Yes.
And yeah, sure, I could see that. Okay. But yes, again, Samuel L. Jackson, sir, if you would ever like to appear on screen with Muppets, please just let us know.
Indeed.
That would be great.
Who would the human be then, though? Like, would the human be the person who was robbed? I'm still on this.
Oh, in the Good Samaritan story. Yeah, I was going to say, Emily, Samuel L. Jackson
is not a Muppet.
Like, we need to...
Yes.
Like, if he wants to have a Muppet version of himself, I'm also up for that, but it's
Oh my
not...
gosh, that's like going a whole, like, the whole Avenue Q direction.
Yeah, look, but no, who would the human be in The Good Samaritan? I could definitely see the human as the person who was robbed. I could also see, like...
Ooh, or the innkeeper.
Right, or just, like, a very confused onlooker, like, wait, what? What is going on
Why
here?
Why is that trash can picking up that?
I'm
person?
Confused. Yeah, this does not make immediate sense to me.
Yeah, I feel like we go through like waves of like we have lots of Elmo, lots of Camilla. Now we're in like lots of Oscar the Grouch.
You've been in a bit of a mood, yes.
Yeah,
but maybe it's I'm not objecting.
Marmy. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, you like Oscar, and I certainly do not object to Oscar, but.
It's true.
He has been coming up more lately, and I think that's mostly been you.
Yeah. Well, dear listeners, thank you for joining us. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 6th Sunday after Pentecost with our special guest, Reverend Nick Peñaranda. This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing, and Kay Roloff. For more fun, check us out on Twitter and Facebook at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. It's cheaper than a Samaritan cookbook.
Truth, I'm assuming.
Yes, I did check. Okay. I think their cookbook is like $15.
Oh, yeah. It is cheaper. Indeed. Also, let us know on Facebook or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christian said,
Pax vobiscum.